Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. It's an extraordinary day today. We have Gavin Menzies, the author of 1421, The Year China Discovered America, and also the author of 1434, How the Chinese Were Behind the Renaissance in Europe. Gavin Menzies, you are rocking the boat of history.
Thank you very much.
You are rocking the boat of history, and everything we've all been taught and told, been indoctrinated to accept, may be in question.
Well, I hope so.
Welcome to It's Rainmaking Time.
Thank you for inviting me on the show.
This was such an exciting book to read. It reads very much like you're there. You're actually there. Who taught you how to write like this? This is like initiatory writing where you go into the time that you're describing.
Well, I'm afraid you're being very flattering. I don't think anyone taught me to write. I left school when I was 15, so I never really learned.
Well, that's a lot of hope for people that have left school that can write so poignantly and elegantly. It really reads easily.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. The first question I want to ask you as an explorer is, what happened to you personally when you began to discover that the information that we have accepted as a fact about the discovery of America may not be true?
Right. Well, my discovery was a complete accident. I didn't set out to prove anything or disprove anything. My wife and I went to Beijing in 1990 to celebrate 25 years of living together. And we got there on New Year's Eve, which was just a coincidence, and there was a wonderful display in the Forbidden City. It was a very beautiful, cold evening, and there were fireworks and goodness knows what else, because it was New Year's Eve. And at the end of the show, I asked our guide, when was this Forbidden City completed? And she said it was completed on New Year's Eve 1421. And this came as a surprise to me because I'd been up the Great Wall that afternoon, and that was also completed in 1421. So I said, well, this is very strange. Lots of things seem to have been completed in 1421. Tell me why. And she said, well, basically, I don't know. But I can tell you that the emperor wanted to build all these projects, and he sent, having done so, he sent a fleet of ships all around the world to bring kings and princes back to Beijing for the inauguration of this Forbidden City on New Year's Day, 1421. Now, I thought this was a very odd thing. When I got back to England, I decided to find out what was happening at the same month in England, in February 1421. So I went down to the local library and museum and records office in the City of London, and I found that it was a very important day in English history because the King, Henry V, had decided he'd bring the Hundred Years' War to an end by marrying the French princess Catherine of Valois, and she was to be crowned in February 1421 in Westminster Cathedral, Westminster Abbey, would become Queen of England, and their son or daughter would become King or Queen of France and England, and that would end the war. So I could compare what was going on at exactly the same time in London and in Beijing. And I found there was a huge disparity between the two. In Beijing, the emperor entertained 26,000 guests, and they had an enormously lavish banquet. In London, the country was so poor, 600 guests only were invited to the coronation of Queen Catherine, and they only had one course, which was dried fish. They had no plates. They ate off stale bread, which served as plates, whereas in Beijing, they ate off the most magnificent imperial blue and white plates. Now, what I did then is I spent some time comparing what was going on in China and in London, and also what was going on around the world on that same in that same month, February 1421. And I spent, in the end, nearly 10 years putting together a book. And at the end of 10 years, I had one which was saleable, and I got a very good literary agent called Luigi Bonomi. And he sold it to a small, reputable publisher who decided before it was published they would like it checked by a lot of historians. So we sent the book out in draft to a number of historians, and one of them said to me, do you know we have a map in our collection, and it was drawn up in 1421, and it shows islands in the Caribbean, or we think it does. What do you think? So I went along and had a look at it. And I saw to my amazement, this map, which was drawn in 1421, published in 1424, had accurately drawn Puerto Rico and Guadalupe in the Caribbean. Now, this was extraordinary because it was 70 years before Columbus. And so I realized that somebody had been in the Caribbean 70 years before Columbus and had accurately charted these islands, which was an astounding story. And that's how it all started. It was all an accident.
Were you both excited and nervous a little bit about the implications of running with that discovery?
I was, very much so, because I wasn't a historian, and I thought, this really can't be true. Now, what I did was, I was sure it was the Portuguese who'd made a secret voyage to the Caribbean 70 years before Columbus. So I told the Portuguese ambassador, and he kindly invited me to meet the keeper of the archives in Lisbon, and we went down there, and we found that the Portuguese hadn't any idea about these islands, where they were accurately, but they knew that there were islands in the Caribbean because their crown prince, Dom Pedro, had brought back to Portugal in 1428 a map which showed the whole world, according to the Portuguese claims. So this was even more incredible. The Portuguese were claiming that in 1428 they had a world map which showed South America's, what we call the Straits of Magellan now, in the west, and in the east it showed the Indies and China and so on. So by this stage, I was absolutely astounded, and I thought, well, nobody's going to believe me. So what I'll do is I'll try and find this map. I instigated a search, and I just couldn't find it anywhere. So then what I did, I decided to look at the logs of Christopher Columbus and Magellan and the other great explorers and see whether, in fact, they did have maps showing them the way to their destinations. I thought, if there was a world map which the Portuguese king owned, and it did show the Americas, then sure as anything, Columbus would have a copy, and so would Magellan, and so would da Gama, and so on. Well, I started searching their logs and diaries, and I found very quickly that each of these great explorers, that is Columbus and Magellan, da Gama, Cabral, Diaz, and Captain Cook, every single one of them accepted they had a map. Columbus accepted he had a map showing him the way to the Americas. And in fact, he had a semi-mutiny on the way over. And to quash it, he said to his crew, look, I know where I'm going because I've got a map. And here it is. And he sent it over to his fellow captain in the other ship. And exactly the same with Magellan. He had a mutiny when he got down to South America. And he quashed the mutiny by telling his sailors that before he set sail, he had seen in the King of Portugal's library a map which showed the straits which he was traveling through.
What does that mean, though?
Same with Cabral, with Diaz, with Captain Cook. Each one of them had a map. So when I found that out, I knew I was on home ground.
But what does that mean? I'm sorry, I just wanted to go back a little bit. What would that mean for the listeners? What would that mean if they had a map? Was it a real map? Was it a map that they made? Was it a map of the Chinese?
It was a map which they were given. For example, Columbus had a map which showed the islands in the Caribbean. Now, the implication are that if you have a map, obviously, the place is already known. So Columbus couldn't claim that he discovered America because he had a map of the islands which he was looking for. Which showed him the way to the Americas. And in fact, since my book's come out, we've found the contract between Columbus and the King of Spain, in which Columbus is not going to discover anything. He's going to be appointed as Viceroy of the Americas, which they weren't called the Americas. They were called lands on the other side of the ocean. So Columbus was not expecting to discover anything new. He was going to be Viceroy of the new lands which had already been discovered. And the same with Magellan. He didn't discover the Straits of Magellan. He had seen them on this map in the King of Portugal's library. So although I was taking a big gamble and historians could attack me, I knew that at the back of it all, I was home and dry, because I could say, well, look, if you preach that Columbus discovered America and Magellan was the first to circumnavigate the world, how come that they set sail with maps? Magellan had a map of the world. Columbus had a map of the Americas. So whenever I was attacked, I just fell back on that, and I knew I was safe, and nobody could explain it. So I was absolutely sure one day we would find the world map which the Chinese had given to the King of Portugal, and that's basically the subject of my second book, 1434, in which the map's been found, and I show it in that book.
What about for the skeptical groups of people who say, how do you make sure that the maps you found are authenticated, so to speak? I'm sure there's a domain in exploration where you have to authenticate or clarify
yes.
that they are what they are.
Yes.
How did you do it, and how did you learn how to do it?
Well, I had quite an advantage, because I'd been a submarine captain, and I looked at land through a periscope, and you see what a sailor sees from a low deck, and that's not the same necessarily as what we see today with the aid of aerial photography and so on. So if you see something from low down in the sea, for example, if you see a group of islands in which in the foreground there are low islands and in the background there are high islands, it looks like a solid chunk of land. And some of the maps, I could argue and show that what the cartographer was drawing were, in fact, groups of island, not solid land, like in the Caribbean. So I knew a bit about maps. Now, nobody has ever challenged the main maps that I relied on when my first book was published. That is the map which Magellan had to go through the Straits of Magellan. That was a map called, his route has been reproduced on a map called the Jean Rots, Piri Reis, before he set sail. So the key maps, the key half dozen maps which I relied on for Magellan's voyage, the Waldseemüller map, for Columbus' voyage, De Virga's map, for Magellan's voyage to South America, the Piri Reis. All of those maps were accepted as genuine. Nobody ever challenged their authenticity, and nobody ever has done. Now, I can say at that stage, well, look, you take Waldseemüller's map, which the Library of Congress owns, that was published in 1507, shows the Americas with great accuracy before Europeans reached them. Now, how on earth did Waldseemüller do that? He was a priest in a remote area of southeast France, which is famous for its plums, but he'd never seen the sea. He'd never been outside his France. So how on earth did this young priest draw a map of the Americas, of 23,000 miles of coastline, before Magellan, before Balboa, before the Europeans got there? I mean, it just doesn't make sense. So whereas the critics could attack me and say I was a nonentity, I wasn't a historian, and so on and so forth, I could say, well, okay, how do you explain these maps? And none of them could explain it. There was a deathly silence. So the public who read my book and read the attacks on me, you know, realized something was completely wrong. It's idiotic to think Columbus discovered America if you can show that he had a chart, a map, showing how to get there, and that he was going there as the viceroy of America rather than as an explorer. So the public accepted by about 99-1 that what I said made sense, and what traditional historians said was absolute nonsense. So it was actually quite an easy passage until we came to the stage when the world map, the Chinese world map, was discovered, the one which was given to the Pope, and who he gave it to the King of Portugal. When that map was found, everyone screamed, this is a fake map. The map was a copy of a Chinese 1418 map, and it showed the Americas quite clearly. It showed Australia, showed New Zealand, showed the whole world drawn up in 1418. So there were screams of outrage from some historians who said it's a fake. And the reason they said it was a fake was because a number of the names on it were in Chinese writing, and they were in a script or describe things which were not in use in China in 1418. For example, they said some of the script was traditional Chinese, and that was only brought in 1949, so it's obviously a fake. Well, what we did is we assembled a team of linguistic experts who knew medieval Chinese, especially early Ming Dynasty Chinese, and they could show that although the critics were correct, some of these words were not in use in early Ming China. Nonetheless, they were in use in the provinces of southwest China amongst the Hui people. And not only that, some of them were bastardized Hui, of the Hui people who lived in Quanzhou. So we could say for sure that the cartographer was Chinese, he was a Hui minority, and he lived in Quanzhou. And that's exactly where the Admiral Zheng He came from. So we could show that every single attack on this 1418 map made by the critics who said it was fake because of this, that, and the other was quite the opposite. We could show not only is it not a fake, but that they didn't understand the language of the time. So we got over that hurdle, and I think now, well, from the emails we get, virtually everyone accepts that what I've written is in fact correct.
This is a real shakeup of history as we know it. It opens the domain for new exploration and expanded discovery. It also means, potentially as a translation, that further examination needs to be done in terms of what we're being told is historical fact.
Yes.
And for people that need to know and need to have everything settled,
yes,
this is very unsettling, and for some it causes hysteria, and
yep,
a lot, you know, they become irrational, and
yes,
I guess the more steeped in a religious point of view one,
yes,
is about something, a body of knowledge or anything,
yes,
when that is shaken, people become zealots sometimes,
yes,
and I think that's what a part of the resistance is from. And I think also, Gavin, there's a sensitivity to, at least at this time in human history, the Chinese effectiveness, success, good fortune, and superiority. There's a sensitivity,
yes,
because the Chinese have done so well in so many things and really are now, and probably what you're showing us has always been, front runners, explorers, discoverers, merchants for a long, long time.
Yes.
And that, you know, it's not new.
I entirely agree with you on both your points. I think that one of the aspects which will require further detailed examination is, how do historians get it so wrong?
Actually, that's what I was going to ask you next, which is kind of astonishing. Can you talk about that?
Yes, certainly. How are they so wrong? I think that the system of peer review is a disaster for historians. Peer review is the system whereby if you have a paper which breaks new ground in any way, then if you're a professional historian or professional biologist or whoever, then what you've got to do is you've got to put it up to review by your peers before it appears in a respectable magazine. So if you want to say, I think that Columbus wasn't the first to get America, then you've got to write a paper and get your fellow historians to look at it. And of course, they have hysterics, thinking that their life's work is going up in smoke. So there's no chance whatsoever of it ever seeing the light of day. So our approach has been exactly the opposite. We basically don't give our findings and discoveries to peer review to anyone. We publish and then wait for the fallout and see what the readers say.
I think that's extraordinary. It's almost like exploration and discovery gone open source. Do you know what I mean?
I don't, I'm afraid.
Okay, no. Well, in the computer industry, electronic industry,
Yeah.
Open source is this open environment where people can share information, they can share discoveries, they can share ideas, paradigms, right, et cetera. And then you can get a better synthesis of something. The more sharing there is of information and checking and cross-checking and people getting involved, you actually end up with a better synthesis and clarity of what's happening and what happened.
Yes.
And well, so you've taken this to what I call an open source level instead of strangling it inside of peer review in that paradigm.
Mm. Well, that's very interesting. I didn't know about that, so I'm thank you for the information. But what's happened is we've gathered, we've had hundreds of thousands of emails over the years, and we've got a website which for which we have 13,500 subscribers, who are people who are knowledgeable about different aspects of life and new discoveries, and above all, open-minded. And they contribute a huge amount. So when we get something new, we put it on our website, and they comment. But they basically are not professional historians. They're biologists, chemists, mathematicians, astronomers, and so on. So we do get a great deal of feedback from what we say is new evidence and so on. And I'm very interested in that you say other people operate in the same way, and we'll look into that. I'm sure we can learn a lot.
Well, you're already doing it. You've already kind of set sail, if you will, with that paradigm and the process. And the fact that you recognize that the peer review function has such constrictive limits,
yes,
that it actually prevents and obstructs discovery and the advent of new knowledge.
It certainly does with history, no question whatsoever. I mean, the more you go into it, the more ridiculous traditional history is. Not only was the world not discovered by the European explorers, but a lot of other things which are credited to European experts were not original ideas or discoveries at all. And that's set out in my second book, 1434, in which we put forward the evidence for the readers to consider that a lot of Renaissance inventions, in inverted commas, that took place in Florence in the golden years of the Renaissance were actually based on Chinese mathematics, astronomy, and so on. And they weren't original. So the further one progresses down this path, you start at the end to question everything.
The way you talk about your process, like things came to you, you ask questions, things didn't add up, things didn't make sense. It's like you followed the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, and before,
yeah,
you know it, you had a tiger by the tail.
well,
right?
I mean, people now bring all sorts of things to our websites. And I've got into the habit of not throwing anything out. So, for example, a chap came along about a week ago and said, look, I can tell you something you don't know, which is that the people from Norway, the Norsemen, conquered Central Arabia 3,000 years ago. So I said, how's this? And he said, because I found rock carvings in Sweden of their ships, and I found rock carvings in Central Arabia, and they're absolutely identical.
Wow.
So I thought, well, this sounds very odd. It's most unlikely, but I won't discount it immediately. So I went down and looked up these rock carvings, and he's absolutely right. So it seemed as if the Scandinavians had settled in the Middle East and so on, and created their own little fiefdom or empire. And then I looked into it a bit more, and I found that, in fact, there were identical rock carvings, exactly the same ships, in North America, in Sicily, Sardinia, Eastern Mediterranean, Egypt, etc., and so on. So these exactly similar ships could be shown from North America right the way to southern India. And what I found out is that this chap had got it the wrong way around. It wasn't Norwegians who came to the Near East. It was people from the Near East who travel around the world. So I sort of cite that as an example of not discounting anything immediately.
I think in academia, and I think you could agree with me just based on your experience, the need to know, the need to be right, the need to have the final say is in the way of all exploration
yes,
and discovery.
I absolutely agree. That's another thing I've learned, that for goodness sake, don't say you've got the final answer. I mean, I'm absolutely sure that people will come along and say, well, you say the Chinese discovered the world in 1421. I can show you that XYZ discovered the world 2,000 years before that. Sure as anything, they will. And then someone else will come along and say, well, I found a civilization that's discovered the world 9,000 years ago.
Look how exciting that is, though.
It is. It's very exciting.
How can you go back into ancient civilizations or ancient history and not be excited and have a childlike mind, a wonder about other links and other things we don't know that we're finding? See, that's exciting.
I entirely agree with you. It's thrilling, and I think DNA is an absolutely fascinating tool in discovering this. For example, just recently, a haplogroup X has been found, which was unknown before, and this is one of the very rare groups which is prevalent amongst certain North American peoples who live around the Great Lakes. Now, that can be tied in with people who have this X haplogroup in the Near East, in the Mediterranean, and so on and so forth, to show that people traveled from Europe and the Central and Eastern Mediterranean to North America 4,000 years ago. And similarly, one is able to trace where the Chinese went in 1420s by the DNA of peoples across the Pacific from China to Pacific Coast of America and so on. So I think DNA is a very, very important tool that will be used more and more as time goes by.
Do you ever wonder if, given some of the abuses in the world with science, that we can trust that DNA was implanted in places, that it actually was there? Again, you'll hear me kind of going back to authenticating things. Do you feel comfortable with the way it's practiced?
Well, I'm sure it will be improved. I mean,
yeah, because we've had some developments with the way DNA is accessed. And
yeah.
So.
Well, I think it's a very, very good marker of where people went. The problem is, when did they go? And that, I think, needs an enormous amount of work to be able to date the migrations of peoples by mutations in DNA. Once that's solved, then I think we'll have a completely different view on how the world is populated. Well, I mean, one of the most extraordinary things to me is how experts still try and hold to the concept that America was peopled by people crossing the Bering Straits when it was frozen. It's a matter of common sense. Why on earth would anyone want to trek 4,000 miles in the bitter cold to go from Northeast Asia into North America across the ice fields? Why not go south and island hop from place to place where you've got food? So I think that's another sort of tenet which has been held for a hell of a long time is going to go for a ball of chalk as well, the fact that America was not populated across the Bering Straits.
So the question then is, who writes history?
Who writes history? Well, I suppose if we put that question on our website, 90% of the people who replied would say the victors do. The vanquished have no chance.
Did Queen Isabella fund Columbus for whatever was going on? What is the truth about that?
She did fund Columbus. She and Ferdinand. I mean, his timing was impeccable. He arrived at their court just when she'd expelled the Moors from Granada. So they had finished fighting for the moment, but they wanted to pursue the people they thought were wicked. That's Islam abroad. So Columbus's timing was flawless. Isabella was ill at the time, so he eventually ended up signing the contract with Ferdinand to go to the Americas. As I say, he was going to the Americas as viceroy.
And what does that mean, though, in terms of his role? What does that translate as? What does viceroy mean?
He was ruling the country. He was to rule America on behalf of Spain. And they were very legalistic in those days. They laid out all sorts of provisions about how he should behave. And they were very concerned for the native people that they should be treated fairly and honorably. And so Columbus had a whole raft of instructions how he was to govern and behave, which he breached. And so, as you know, he was recalled as viceroy for breach of his duties. And he died basically a poor man without recognition. And then there was a huge lawsuit that went on for nearly 100 years between Columbus' descendants trying to claim back the titles and so on that he was granted before his disgrace.
Were people mad at you when you published this book, 1421?
I think, funny enough, I had a pretty easy ride, far easier than I thought. I mean, the thing that terrified me was if I had made some obvious howling mistake, I'd said they visited a port which was 2,000 feet up a mountain or something. But fortunately, there weren't any howlers like that. And I could always go back to my central plank, which was that none of the European famous explorers actually discovered anything, because they all knew where they were going, because they all, by their own admission, had maps. So nobody could explain that. So in a way, it was quite easy. There was quite a lot of contention when I argued in my second book that Leonardo, although he's a brilliant genius and a wonderful artist and superb draftsman, he basically was not an inventor. He improved on the work of others. Virtually every drawing of a machine that he made, he improved on an existing drawing, which he had a book of drawings of all these different machines. And he got that book of drawings from an Italian who got it from another Italian who got it from the Chinese. So that created a lot of upset. People were very, very upset about what they thought was my attack on Leonardo, which wasn't an attack at all, because I kept saying what a brilliant genius he was. But that was, of course, a lot of upset.
You say that the Chinese were centuries ahead of Europe, and that really the Europeans were standing on the shoulders of giants, in effect.
That's correct, yeah.
You say kind of 5 centuries ahead of Europe. That's huge.
Yes, yes it is. But it's true.
The emperor of China, that is the whole first 100 pages of the book that you talk about, is it Zhu Di?
Zhu Di, yeah.
Zhu Di, who commissioned 1,681 new ships.
Yes.
Talk about that.
And well, it's, as you say, it's absolutely phenomenal undertaking, but he did. He built 7 shipyards, and some of them were the most enormous docks, and he commissioned this huge fleet of getting on for 2,000 ships. Now, he did this at the same time as he built the Forbidden City and repaired the Great Wall and built the Temple of Heaven. And in fact, what happened was that China was denuded of trees. So they had to, he sent an eunuch army into Vietnam to pillage the trees in northern Vietnam for China. This led to a war, which the Vietnamese were very ably represented and led. And it tied down huge armies, Chinese armies in the jungle. So China had her Vietnam 600 years before America. And in fact, that's what brought Zhu Di down, because the war in Vietnam sapped China's energy and strength, just about bankrupted the country. And Zhu Di's ministers resigned or committed suicide or were sacked, and the whole government fell apart in the summer of 1421. And really, that was the end of the party for Zhu Di.
You talk heavily about the critical importance of astronavigation and how extraordinarily important and critical it was that the Chinese understood and had full access to astronavigation that nobody else did. Explain that to the public, because I found that to be important.
Well, you've got to know to make maps of the world, you've got to know where you are at any particular ship. A captain's got to know where he is so that he can draw an accurate map. If he didn't know where he was, all the captains would come home with drawings of distant lands, but they'd all be just a hopeless, incoherent jumble. So you can't start drawing world maps until you can accurately determine your position in the ocean. Now, the ocean, of course, has no signposts, so you've got to find a way of knowing where you are. And the only way you can do that is by using astro-navigation, that is, by using objects in the heavens, either the moon, the sun, stars, planets, or whatever. Now, there are some very simple ways that you can work out your position north or south of the equator and your position east or west of it. Now, starting with your position north or south of the equator, at the extension of the Earth's axis, billions of miles away in space, there's a star currently called Polaris. If you're at the North Pole, Polaris is right above you, 90 degrees elevation, so you look right up above your head, there is Polaris. Because it's so far away, that same star is on the horizon if you're on the equator. So by measuring the height of that particular star in the sky, you know how far north or south of the equator you are. So that's very important and very useful. The second point is longitude. East or how far are you east or west? And this you can do by describing or seeing an object in the heavens at the same time across the world. For example, if the moon eclipses and the observer in Beijing notes it eclipsed at midnight, whereas the observer in the Indian Ocean noticed it eclipsed 6 hours later, then you can say, because 6 hours is one quarter of 24 hours, that you are a quarter of the world away from the observer in Beijing, or 90 degrees away. So eclipse of the moon will enable you to determine longitude without using clocks. So by using Polaris and by using eclipses of the moon, a navigator could see where he was on the Earth's surface, and similarly could determine when he came to new land how far east of Beijing or how far west of Beijing, how far north or south of Beijing he was. And that's really, in a nutshell, how they did it.
Hasn't this been going on for 2,000 years that the Chinese have been recording events in the night sky?
It has indeed. Now, this is a rather interesting illustration of what you've been describing. The Chinese have been charting the stars in the sky every night for 2,000 years, as you say, and they have noted the exact positions of 1,450 stars when they rise and when they set, and where the moon is when they're rising and setting, and so on. So
that's huge.
It is. It's absolutely massive. But friends of our website have brought information to me, which is completely rivetingly interesting, was that the Babylonians could, in fact, make those same measurements in 1800 BC. So the Babylonians, in fact, were 1,800 years ahead of the Chinese, and they could draw up star tables, planet tables, lunar tables, sun tables, and so on. So they could actually calculate longitude and latitude 3,800 years ago.
Amazing.
It is. It's just astounding. Terribly interesting.
And I bet it goes on and on, too.
It does. Oh, absolutely.
It's like a rabbit hole of exploration and discovery where everything is up to be looked at and renewed in a
absolutely
totally new way.
Absolutely. And sure as anything, someone will come along and say, well, before the Babylonians in 9,000 BC, there was X, Y, Z could do it. I'm sure of that.
What is this huge encyclopedia project that you talk about on page 62 of 1421, the year China discovered America? Share about that. That seems like a massive, massive project that then... what happened to it?
Well, it was. The Emperor Zhu Di was a gigantic figure, and he decided that he would codify and record every single thing which Chinese scientists, astronomers, geographers, physicists, chemists had found over the preceding 2,000 years of Chinese history. And he had a team of 3,000 scholars working on this gigantic encyclopedia. And they worked for years and years and years. And then when the Forbidden City was inaugurated in 1421, this massive encyclopedia, 10,000 volumes, was placed in the Emperor's Library in the Forbidden City. So it was a huge, huge undertaking. And sadly, it's been in the Boxer Uprising and the European invasions and so on. It's great. Most of this huge encyclopedia has been destroyed, but bits and pieces are still available in America and Chicago and in Cambridge University and so on.
I wonder if other countries have had projects like that where that level of knowledge is assembled and synthesized and stored somewhere. That would be interesting to note.
It would. I don't know, I'm afraid.
The Grand Canal that you talk about, where 6 million people who worked on it perished.
Yes.
Describe it. It was so disturbing, and yet 6 million people is a lot of people. That was huge. Talk about that.
It was. Well, the Chinese needed to get... You can't grow grain very well in northern China because it's very cold in winter, and you can't grow rice at all. And so they needed to ship rice from the warm, fertile south up. When Zhu Di, the emperor, moved his capital from Nanjing in the south to Beijing in the north, they had a huge problem with feeding everyone. So to feed them, he decided to build this Grand Canal and build thousands of special craft to ply up and down the canal, and they would carry the rice up to the north. Now, the problem was that Beijing is higher than Nanjing in altitude, and there were various hills en route, so they had to have a system of locks. So they could get ships up the hill and down the hill going from Nanjing to Beijing. So at the same time as they dug this huge canal, they built a very clever lock system which enabled ships to traverse the canal as and when they wanted.
So why did 6 million people perish building the Grand Canal?
Well, I must confess, I'd forgotten that I said they perished. Millions perished. I think basically they didn't have enough food.
Wow,
China was a slave society. I regret to say, in Judy's time, in practice, so not necessarily that wasn't necessarily the intention, but Judy's extravaganzas in building this vast fleet, in building the Grand Canal, rebuilding the Great Wall, building the Temple of Heaven and the Emperor's tombs and all the rest of it, it basically bankrupted China to such an extent the poor farmers were reduced to eating grass. They had absolutely nothing. And so to this day, Zhu Di is a very, very unpopular emperor.
Wow. What can you say about the other evidence? The treasure fleet runs aground. Some of the other evidence for people to be pondering, and why should they read this book?
Well, why should they read it? I suppose I'd answer because people in 130 other countries have read it, so there must be some reason. People do. They're not all mad. I hope they'll find it interesting. They might not, but if they do, I hope they'll join the club. They'll email us with what they consider is right about the book and wrong about the book and new discoveries. We rely on a continuous flood of new evidence.
Do people support your continued work besides buying the books? Are they sending in donations to you, or how does it work now?
No donations, but evidence. What we crave new evidence, and that as long as that pours in, we're fine because we can write new books. So every day we have this stream of new evidence comes in, which is completely fascinating.
The thing that's kind of refreshing about all of this is that you're willing to be wrong. You're willing to have made a mistake. You're willing for your findings to be expanded or changed, et cetera, or if there's a earlier discovery that you're not ready to squelch discoveries that came even before this. I think that's extraordinary.
Well, you're very kind, but you must remember I have personally discovered just about nothing. Almost everything which has come to our website, which has enabled us to write new books and so on, has been through readers of the books and their ideas. So I'm in a very fortunate position that I know very little, and therefore I look forward to reading what people say.
Marcella, your wife, has been hugely empowering and inspirational and traveled with you and been a huge support of your projects.
Yes, she has.
How has she taken the information? Has she been as excited as you? How has it worked for her along the way?
I think she's much more pragmatic than I am. She's much more sensible and down to earth. But yes, she's very, very excited. I mean, she has her own business. She owns a business center. And so she's got a full-time job on that. And that's what really financed my research in the early days. So she's obviously delighted. And it's very, very interesting. I mean, we do travel a lot, give talks all over the place. And that's very interesting for her. She meets new people, and so she loves it, yeah.
I think it's extraordinary, too, that she's so heavily supported the discoveries and the exploration work, because it's uncommon, actually. These projects are so huge and have such wide-range ramifications that, on a personal note, if you don't have the right personal support, sometimes even putting all this together can be obstructed. So I think it's an extraordinary blessing that you've had with her.
Well, thank you.
It's true. I agree. It's really, really true. And it can make or break your ability to function and think clearly and assemble. And so God bless you, Marcella, for all the work you've done and support to Gavin and the projects and all of it.
I'll tell her. She'd be very pleased.
But it's really, really is true. The thing that struck me in 1421, and it's a side note, I never knew this, was about the role of eunuchs in protecting the aura and sanctity and secrecy of the imperial throne. Yes. I was shocked by that.
Yes, it's a disgusting custom. Why on earth the emperor did it, I cannot think. I mean, castrating people is just barbaric. But even more extraordinary, those who were castrated remained extraordinarily loyal, which is just totally bizarre to my way of thinking.
I understand when Zhu Di passed on that many of the women were buried alive with him.
Yeah, I'm afraid that's true. Yes, they were.
That was pretty shocking.
Horrible. Yes, he was an exceptionally cruel man, as well as being exceptionally ambitious and clever.
The ships you describe are huge and advanced, the Chinese ships that set sail.
Yeah.
What was different about those ships than the ships that were used to set sail with Columbus and Magellan?
Well, Columbus and Magellan's fleets could both have been put in the hold of one of Zheng He's ships. I mean, they were just gigantic. They were over 400 foot long, the biggest ones, over 100 foot wide. They could carry 1,000 people. They could stay at sea for weeks and weeks on end. They grew their own rice and their own vitamins. They kept animals in coops. They kept fish in tanks. They could desalinate seawater.
That is extremely advanced.
Yeah. It was. They were technical marvels. And funny enough, the docks where they were built, you can go and see them in Nanjing today. You can just see the huge size of the dry docks in central Nanjing.
Do some people think that you are Chinatizing, if you will, the world by, I guess, pointing and illuminating the level at which the Chinese have contributed to the world?
Well, I mean, I like Chinese people. I lived there when I was tiny.
How old were you when you lived in China?
First 2 years of my life I was in China. And then my armor came back to England with us when my father came and mother came back. So I had a Chinese armor until I was six.
Do you speak?
And those days, armors used to bring up children, European children.
Hmm. Do you speak the language?
I don't anymore. I'm afraid I did then, but not now. But I mean, people say I'm a Chinese freak or nutter. I think that it is only fair to put their achievements on the record if one believes it's true, and I do believe it's true, and I think it's the correct thing to do as a result.
Can you speak for just a few more minutes with us about the voyages to Antarctica?
Yep.
That, and I know there was one also to Australia, but the one to Antarctica is very, very interesting as well.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Well, how do we know they got down to the Antarctic? Basically because of the maps and the accounts. There are accounts in China that Zheng He indeed got down there. Why did they go down to the Antarctic? They went down to determine the position of a star in the southern hemisphere called Canopus. Now, Canopus, to the Chinese, was the emperor of stars because it was very far south, and because it was subpolar, other stars rotated around it, so it was likened to the courtiers of the emperor, circling the emperor. The star Canopus had other satellite stars, so to speak, circling around it. So, and that was really the first purpose, go down and measure the position of Canopus. And that Canopus is vertically above one when one's right down in the Antarctic near South Graham Land. And that was the purpose of their first voyages. Now, why they continuing down there in subsequent voyages, I'm afraid I just don't know. It seems a very risky method of operating, and I don't know why they did.
It does. It does seem risky. It seems very much out there. But I didn't know, I had no idea, and I don't think the audiences know either why Antarctica. But I thought it was interesting because Antarctica is very important today.
Right.
And North and South Pole, and all of this is very coveted and very secretive, what goes on there today.
Yes.
And so these are places of interest.
Yeah.
And much politics going on surrounding those areas. So it's interesting to note. It's a huge, huge area.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with audiences today? This is our first time speaking together. And well, I haven't read the other book yet, but I look forward to it. But is there anything else you'd like to say today?
Well, I'm very grateful indeed to have been asked. I would much like, perhaps when you've read the second book, we could have a lengthy conversation.
I would love it.
Screen about your proposals, which I find are the greatest interest.
Thank you very much.
So thank you very much for asking me, and good luck to your audience. I hope some of them will read the book and come join our website. And
absolutely. Let's tell them about it. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been talking with Gavin Menzies, the author of 1421, The Year China Discovered America, and also the author of 1434, about how the Chinese really spurred on the Renaissance in Europe. If you would like to learn more about his work, please pick up the books and also go to 1421.tv. Is that correct, Gavin?
That's correct, yep.
And feel free to leave your email and be in contact and discover the revelations and explorations yourself. And Gavin, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.